California's governor was considering whether to deploy National Guard troops. President Trump is apparently considering whether to respond to last weekend's chemical attack in Syria. On Insight, I'll talk with Ben Adler about the governor's decision, which was announced yesterday. And we'll hear from UC Davis's Dr. Keith Wattenpah. He's working in Beirut and watching from there for news about a possible Syria response. CalPERS CEO Marcy Frost is here today. She's going to talk with me about the solvency of the state employees' retirement fund. We're going to hear about orchids. The 71st annual Sacramento Orchid Society show and sale is this weekend. And we'll finish the hour with four beautiful recordings of classical music and some of the stories behind the music. CAP Radio host Kevin Doherty will join me. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. California National Guard troops will be deployed. Governor Jerry Brown's office announced that decision yesterday. President Trump tweeted, "Thank you, Jerry," this morning. And CAP Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler is standing by to talk about this decision. Hi, Ben.
Hey, you know, I missed that tweet. I'm glad you flagged it.
He did. He said, "Thank you, Jerry."
But there Are they on a first-name basis?
Well, he made it that way, and that's an important point, isn't it, that this move by the governor does say something or does something for the relationship between California and the Trump administration, one would assume?
Well, you can look at it through a certain lens, and I think we heard Leon Panetta, the former White House chief of staff and defense secretary to Democratic presidents and a former California congressman, talk about that the other day, where, you know, there is this thing still that exists of mutual aid and collaboration on some basic things between the federal and state governments that historically have been beyond politics. So, you know, for example, the Trump administration has approved every single federal disaster relief
right.
request that the state has requested. And so here you have the governor on his terms, not necessarily on the president's terms, finding a way to work with the Trump administration.
There was more than a week of silence between President Trump's request to the number of states, including California, and Governor Brown's response yesterday. So what do you know now about what was happening during that time?
Clearly, they were working out terms under which the governor would be willing to say yes and accept the federal funds to deploy troops. And so we can really quickly go through these. The roughly 400 National Guard troops that the governor's agreed to accept federal funding for, they won't all report to the Mexican border. They won't do any immigration enforcement. Instead, under the memorandum of agreement that Brown has submitted to the Trump administration, the troops are going to join an existing program that seeks to crack down on transnational crime. So gangs, human traffickers, illegal gun and drug smugglers. And besides the border, they'll be based also along the coast and throughout the state. But they'll only be there through the end of September unless both sides agree to an extension. So you can see the governor has set some pretty clear terms.
Do you think, Ben, that the governor was initially against any kind of deployment?
I don't know, and the governor's office has been so quiet throughout. What I would say is that the political knee-jerk response to say no right away, Jerry Brown has never, at least in his latest governorship, done that much that has been a political knee-jerk response. So he took his time and made a decision.
Say something about the power in this kind of situation that a governor has in responding to a presidential request.
Yeah, it's all the governor. It's all on the governor's side, not the president's. And let's hear now from USC law lecturer Dwight Sterling, who's written a legal paper about this very dynamic.
The governor, as the commander-in-chief, gets to determine the rules of engagement. He will receive the additional funding from the federal government, and he gets to set the terms for what is, you know, troops do. So he can utilize them the way that he wants to. They can be on the border. They can, you know, not be on the border. That's one of the benefits that, you know, comes from being in command. And when it's the California National Guard, it's the governor who's in command.
All right. That states that pretty clearly. He said additional funding. So with 400 troops being deployed in some way, do we know anything about the funding amount from the feds?
I don't have a dollar figure, but what will happen here is that the feds will foot the cost, so it won't be California footing the cost.
Tell me about some of the other reaction to the governor essentially saying yes.
Well, I think, well, he said yes, but there were so many asterisks, so many caveats that, you know, as I wrote in my story at capradio.org, it's not entirely clear whether the president is getting anything near what he originally asked for, even though the White House and the Department of Homeland Security and, according to the tweet that you mentioned, the president himself are willing to just take this win and keep moving. I've seen, you know, some critics. I saw former Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon put out a statement and he is running for U.S. Senate as a progressive. He said, look, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. That said, at least we're doing it the way the governor's doing it. I got an email with a petition this morning, thousands of Californians signing it, asking the governor not to accept it. On the other hand, here's Republican political consultant Rob Stutzman, who has a different take.
I thought it was impressive that Governor Brown took the opportunity to just make a good governing decision, which is there's more money here available for him to be able to send his guard troops to the border to specifically interdict human trafficking and drug trafficking.
Ben, even with all the response, the governor chose to just put out a press statement, a written statement, correct? He's not really doing interviews or being very public on camera about this, correct?
Correct. And I couldn't even get someone from his office or the National Guard. They're just standing on the letter and the memorandum of agreement. So let me read you a quick quote from the governor in his letter. Let's be crystal clear on the scope of this mission. This will not be a mission to build a new wall. It will not be a mission to round up women and children or detain people escaping violence and seeking a better life, and the California National Guard will not be enforcing federal immigration laws.
Okay, I'm going to refer people to the story you mentioned, which is posted at capradio.org. There's a lot more background on this, and I imagine there'll be a little more conversation tomorrow in Capital Chat about it, Ben.
Anytime.
Thanks so much.
You got it.
That was Ben Adler, Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, and you can find more at capradio.org. Now we're going to shift to a decision President Trump is weighing, and that is what, if anything, to do in response to the chemical attack in Syria last weekend. I said he was tweeting about Governor Brown's decision. He also tweeted this morning that any decision regarding Syria could be very soon or not so soon at all. I talked with Dr. Keith Wattenpah, the founding director of the UC Davis Human Rights Studies Program. We've consulted him many times in the past about the Syrian civil war. He's working in Beirut this month, and we connected by phone yesterday. I asked what news he's hearing there in Lebanon related to a possible U.S. response.
One of the interesting things is that Middle East Air, the leading airlines here in Lebanon, has decided to reroute all its flights in order to do its best to avoid Syrian airspace in anticipation of missiles, anti-missiles, airplanes, what could take place over the next 24 to 48 hours.
You've studied Syria and the conflict closely. What's your sense of what the U.S. is poised to do and the timing of it?
I think we're at it's always hard to say we're at a crossroads, but there just feels something different. One feels something a little bit different this time, especially because use of chemical weapons seemed to have been presaged by Donald Trump saying that the U.S. was withdrawing from Syria, and that it happens almost at the same time as a very audacious raid by the Israeli Air Force on Iranian interests in Syria. This coming, you know, and then sort of becoming inflamed by Twitter with a kind of one-upsmanship rather than statesmanship in exchanges between the U.S. and Russia, or in particular between President Trump and those who respond to him on the Russian side.
You and I spoke a year ago, almost to the day, about the chemical mm-hmm. attack that had happened at that time and the airstrikes ordered by President Trump. How is this different?
It's different in one main respect, which is it appears that the United States is seeking to coordinate its action with Great Britain and France to bring in a broader coalition of NATO members to take action in Syria. I think this is 99% bluster, frankly, at this point, and that military action, if and when it is taken, will be coordinated with some of our allies and will lead to a largely, again, symbolic effect, but it will be calculated not to produce a situation that would bring the Russians into the fight. You know, this is a moment when, you know, ultra-nationalist dialogue, when undiplomatic language really can cause misunderstanding and misinformation across international boundaries. And that's in some respects one of the reasons why this is so different.
You're listening to Dr. Keith Wattenpah. He is professor and founding director of the UC Davis Human Rights Studies Program. He's talking with us from Beirut, where he is working this month on a project called Article 26 Backpack. It was inspired by a student he met who was carrying all of her educational materials to continue going to school in her backpack. So, Dr. Wattenpah, what's the update on the work you're doing now?
We've designed a online cloud-based but also very human-oriented system to upload and store and give students an opportunity to safely and securely share their data with universities and employers and other people who might be able to help them. We're about to sign up our very first backpackers in the next couple weeks. We're cooperating with a really talented team of designers at UC Davis's Informational Technology Division to build a first-of-its-kind, refugee-focused piece of software, which we hope will make a difference in the lives of not hundreds of refugee university students, but tens of thousands of displaced refugee students from around the world.
That was Dr. Keith Wattenpah of UC Davis talking with me yesterday from Beirut, Lebanon. NPR and CAP Radio will bring you any news related to Syria over the days ahead. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. CalPERS manages pension and health benefits for nearly 2 million state employees in California. It is the California Public Employees Retirement System. And there have been concerns, unproven concerns at times, that the fund is insolvent. The agency, however, just released a report titled A Solid Foundation for the Future. The report outlines the steps that are being taken to ensure long-term sustainability. And in the studio with me to address this is CalPERS CEO Marcy Frost. Hi, Marcy. Thanks
Hi,
for
Beth.
Being here. So how does CalPERS solvency right now, and say the percentage that it's at, compare to CalSTRS or public employee pensions of other states?
Okay. Thank you for the question. So our current funded status, which is really an indicator of health of the fund, is right around 71%. And that number has been improving over the last 2 years. It has moved from a 64% up to a 71% in a relatively short period of time. There are systems around the United States that are in a better funded position, and there are more systems that really are in a less funded position.
So I'm looking at your report, and it looks like the lowest the fund has been is 61%. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
So what's an ideal percentage of solvency looking forward?
So this is something, you know, obviously we pay close attention to. So one of the things that we have incorporated in the way that we manage the operation is what we call an enterprise performance management system. And the funded status of the plan being one of the key indicators of health is first and foremost in that plan. And what we have the current threshold set at is 80% and above brings us out of what I would consider red zone. And once we get to 90% or above, we're really in the green zone, which also provides a number of options for the fund.
There are times historically when the fund has been over 100%, as recently as 2007, I believe. So what's the roadway look like to get back to 100% or higher?
Yeah, so that 2007 number obviously was before the financial downturn.
Yes.
And what we have to be keenly focused on is getting back to a healthier funded status. So a couple of decisions I think that are really important to talk about. One is a decision that was made in December of last year, which lowered the assumed rate of return from 7.5 down to 7.
Would you explain for someone who has these benefits right now and just heard you say that?
Yes.
What that actually means. What is the new asset allocation?
So when we look at the liabilities, and we have about $500 billion in liabilities, we sit at about $360 billion in assets under management. And that's where you get close to that 71% number. We have to look at the future liabilities, bring them back to present day, and say, and look at the markets. Look at the markets over a 10-year period of time. Look at the markets over a 50-year period of time. When we did that, it's also called the capital market assumptions. The 10-year return is around 6.1, 6.2 when you look at our asset allocation. Asset allocation is simply the way that we deploy our capital into different what we call asset classes like public equity, private equity, real estate, and how we deploy those across those classes as well as how we deploy across various geographies as well. And what we did in December is, in working with a number of our stakeholders who were very concerned about increased cost, but we also understood that there were risks to the system, 10-year risks. And when you're underfunded, we have to pay a little closer attention to short-term risk. We are long-term investors, so really our focus has to stay on the long-term. But again, because of that funded status being a little bit lower than what we want it to be, we also have to look at the 10-year return. So the 10-year return was 6.1 to 6.2. The longer return was right around 8 based on this asset allocation, and I can talk a little more about that. But when you bring that back to what the discount rate or the assumed rate of return should be in the short run, that's where we landed on that 7% return target. And that 7% is being phased in over time to help the employers be able to plan their budgets appropriately.
Some people will read and understand the fine print and closely track what you just described. For other people, if there's a myth circulating about the fund being insolvent and you're still below what you would consider at least a good 80% target, there can be great concern that if another financial crisis comes, this fund is fragile and can break. So how do you address mm-hmm. those concerns? And where did those stories come from that the fund is insolvent?
So again, I believe the number one indicator of health is that funded status. So anytime a critic might look at something that's under the 80% or under the 90%, they're going to be concerned about the financial health of the system. But again, we are a long horizon investor. We've been in business for 85 years. We're going to continue to be in business. We are not insolvent. But there is a path, and there are very difficult decisions that have to be made. And those difficult decisions will cost local government, state government, additional money to be able to continue to shore up this system. But the system is on a positive trajectory. Again, that funded status moving from 64 to 71% over the last approximately 18 months. Those are positive indicators. But that does not come without some risk, market risk, as you've already indicated. The markets are volatile by nature. They're unpredictable by nature, which is why we pay such close attention to asset allocation to make sure that we have diversification in our portfolio.
There is criticism of the choices that are being made in investment and, in fact, some demands by some retirees and other recipients that money be pulled out of certain areas, companies that deal in guns, fossil fuels. And I think there's a question about how much money is in real estate, too. So how do you address that and this claim that you're sort of a social warrior in some ways?
Right. Our primary duty is to pay benefits, and our board understands that. The team at CalPERS certainly understands that. And the debate between, you know, should we divest from a company because maybe that company doesn't align with social policy or some of our members' interests, very important. But the fiduciary duty of this board is to be able to pay benefits for the long run. And, you know, we had a board meeting here last month that was really difficult to get through. We had a number of family members, the victims, family members who came to the board and asked us to divest from retailers who were continuing to sell guns.
Because this was after Parkland.
It was after Parkland, exactly. And what CalPERS has a unique voice in that we have a very large voice when we choose to use it. And it's not that divestment isn't ever off the table, but we don't lead with divestment. We lead with engagement. We lead with this very loud voice that CalPERS is able to have on behalf of our members and the scale in which we are able to invest our $360 billion. People do listen to CalPERS.
But what was the response to that call? And has there been as intense a call like that in the history that you know of CalPERS?
Right. So I've been here 18 months. I came from another system, just a couple states north. And I know after the Sandy Hook tragedy, the board did make a divestment decision to not invest any longer in gun retailers.
Right.
That position is still in place, or that policy is still in place. This was about whether we should invest in retailers of guns that are outlawed in California. So these would be companies like Walmart, companies like Big Five. And what we have found through very active engagement, and we have a very good team in the investment office who does this, is that the policies that the board members, as well as some of our public commenters, were asking to have happen, actually the retailers did do. And we believe we had a part of that. We were not the primary part of that. I think it was really this student activism around this policy topic that caused these retailers to change their policies. But we certainly had a role in that. We feel really confident about it. And the outcome is we didn't have to use divestment to get to the same outcome. The outcome was the retailers changed their policies based on engagement.
You're listening to CalPERS CEO Marcy Frost. I referenced a new report and will post a link to it. It's titled A Solid Foundation for the Future. The White House and President Trump in particular are talking about the possibility of a trade war with China. So what's the exposure of the fund and its assets in that case?
Right. So obviously we have investments around the globe. We have a team keenly focused on risks, again, short-term risks that might be international or national policy. Our team has not made any changes to, you know, the way that we invest right now, but it's something that we're keenly watching.
At both the city level, and meaning the League of California Cities, and the state level, with Governor Brown leading the voice, there has been a focus on the expectation of the liability climbing and the question of whether promises made to retirees need to be honored or could be tampered with. Is this a fluid conversation from your view, or are your boundaries around listening and responding rock solid?
Yeah, our boundaries at CalPERS are pretty clear. So the role of CalPERS is to pay the benefits. We do not get involved in the benefit design itself. Benefit design is determined by the legislature and ultimately the governor. And the governor and the legislature did make changes in 2013 for all new entrants coming into the system. They enter into a new tier called PEPRA. And I happen to be one of the PEPRA members. So, you know, the Supreme Court will have to make a determination on the legalities related to the constitutional protections of defined benefit plans. Fortunately, that's not something CalPERS weighs too much in on. We focus on investments. We focus on servicing our members extremely well. And we focus on understanding the demographic and economic assumptions that have to go into funding a pension plan. That's where we operate.
It looks by the report as if you've moved certain segments of the numbers. There's a shorter amortization. We talked about the asset allocation. So you are making shifts as the economy changes. What's the biggest challenge right now in managing this fund and trying to grow it at the pace you're growing it?
So I would say one of the challenges, and we're hearing this loud and clear from the employers, we have about 4,000 employers who are members of CalPERS, and which means all of their employees are members of CalPERS. I would say affordability is one of the significant challenges for both local government, state, schools. And the amortization.
You say that nicely. And from the employer side, yeah. It's, is this fund going to break us? That's how serious the question is.
And we've been talking to a number of employers, and in those conversations, I sense agreement that these financial policies had to change. These were not sound financial policies. Having a 30-year amortization to pay off what is called the unfunded actuarial liability is not something that our actuaries felt was within their professional judgment. And we have to listen to the experts in order to get the system or have the system continue on the right trajectory. So our role is to make sure that the employers understand the cost, understand the decisions that have to be made to make this system sustainable for the long run. Now, my sense, again, in talking with the employers, and I've been out talking, you know, California State Municipal Finance Officers Association and others, is that people understand that these decisions have to be made. But now we have to make sure that they understand the impacts to their budgets. And we are hearing from cities that this is really difficult.
Marcy, this was a very small conversation about what is very big, important, and complicated in the state. I appreciate you coming in to address this. I wonder, in looking back at that time, when the percentage, the funded percentage, was down as low as 61%, did CalPERS at that point have a warning or an ominous message? Because the report, the tone can always be positive and hopeful. Mm-hmm. But what was being said when it was that low?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one of the critical things that were being said at that time, or that was being said at that time, is a system of our scale and magnitude at 61% funded. What we have to be really watchful of is this that the system does not go down to that 50% level. It would be very difficult to recover from a 50% funded status for a system of this size and magnitude. So that was certainly one of the messages that was coming out from the system at the time that it was 61% funded, which again is why we have to be very focused on return. We have to be very focused on risk. It calls for a number of very difficult conversations to have. And one of those difficult conversations is really around this divestment issue. It's very emotional. We're highly empathetic, but we also have to make sure that we are setting the right future for this fund. And again, CalPERS being the biggest U.S. system, the most complex U.S. system, it brings a number of unique challenges about explaining why these decisions have to happen. And my commitment to the members, to the employers, is I will be out there talking about the work that's being done. And the way that I've been discussing it is that these are tough decisions that have to happen today. They have to happen.
When is the next board meeting?
The next board meeting is next week.
And how often do the board meetings happen?
The board meets every month for approximately 2.5 days.
I think we've been in such an interesting time with situations not only in the Sacramento region, but statewide, and the impacts of the Trump administration, that it seems that we should check in again in a few months. And I'd like to see where some of these numbers and patterns are moving. Okay?
Yes, I would appreciate that.
All right. Thank you so much, Beth. Marcy. Marcy Frost is the CEO of CalPERS, the retirement fund of the California State Employees. You can find a link to that report that I referenced at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio, I'm Beth Ruyak. Orchids used to be an unusual and mysterious flower to find and to grow. And that's actually part of why the Sacramento Orchid Society started a show and sale more than 70 years ago. Well, the event is still going strong, and orchids, if you're ever in a grocery store or a big box store, you know they're more popular and more available than ever. In the studio with me is Nick Burnett. He's a retired Sac State Professor Emeritus. He's the president of the Sac State Retirees Association. He's on the board of Capital Public Radio, and
Maybe the most fun credential of all, he's the head judge for this weekend's Orchid Society show. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Glad to have you here. Also in the studio is Dave Veach. He is a software engineer at Intel and chair of the Sacramento Orchid Society show and sale. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Beth.
You have brought some beautiful color with you, and this is really orchid season, isn't it, Dave?
It definitely is.
So give me a bit more of the mystique surrounding this flower. Nick?
Well, there are over 25,000 species of orchids, but of course, man can't let that alone. And we've made hundreds of thousands of hybrids because we're always looking for better color, longer lasting flowers, easier to grow. And so orchid hybridizers over the last 150 years have been working towards more beautiful flowers. And the real difference in the last 15 years or so is that they're now less expensive.
Right.
They're more available in places you never saw them before. You could never go to a Safeway 20 years ago probably and buy an orchid, but you certainly can today.
Women can't let them go either, I will say. But they can be as intimidating as they are gorgeous.
And they really shouldn't be, because orchids like temperatures that people like. Orchids you can usually take a fair amount of sunshine. You do have to worry on some of them whether or not you burn the leaves, but that's a very small minority. And most of what you're getting in grocery stores, for instance, are absolutely growable in the home.
Nick, what's available, or I'm going to put this question to Dave, what's available at the show? How has what the Orchid Society is doing with the show changed over time with the availability?
Well, of course, back, years ago, you would find mostly phalaenopsis. You would find some paphiopedilums. You would find a dendrobium like this, for instance. And, so over time, the variety of species available has, just absolutely ballooned. And so you'll find that many of our vendors will have things that you won't find in the big box stores. And that's one of the reasons to come to the show, is because you're going to see things that you probably haven't seen before ever.
The orchid in front of me, and the name of it is?
This one is a Dendrobium Love Memory Fizz.
Really? It is so tropical and delicate, and light green leaves, a variegated purple and white flower, like a jewel.
And this one I actually grow outside.
Oh.
And as I mentioned, you're going to take this one home with you this today, Beth.
<you. laughs>
And this particular orchid, for instance, during the winter, you bring it in the house and you don't water it for about 3 months. And that way, what it does is it mimics the natural environment, because this dendrobium grows, I believe this is in the Far East. And typically, the monsoons are in the summertime, and then in the winter, they don't get near as much rain. And so what happens is that is what will trigger this guy to bloom.
So thank you for bringing up the way to care for them, because when I first started with orchids, I did what the little tag on the plant instructed me to do, which was in the middle of winter, I covered them with a paper bag. I put them in a certain window. I put them in the garage so that they'd be cold. I went through this whole mechanism to get it right, and that actually worked, and it gave me confidence. But I have found with the same plants, I don't really need to do that, Nick.
No, and so much of this is now grown in big commercial greenhouses, and they're really optimized for the home instead of being more like out in the wilds, and therefore it's become much easier to get plants to rebloom than they would have, say, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, everything was grown in specialty greenhouses. They were far more expensive and often far more challenging to grow for the home grower. We've really taken on a European attitude towards orchids. Over there, they're referred to as pot plants, and that's not pot
really,
but, which means you buy them and you enjoy the flowers and you throw them away. Now, that kind of makes us a little crazy, and one of the things that we do at the Orchid Society is hope people can learn how to grow them and bring them back into bloom year after year.
Oh, it's so exciting. Yeah. I don't know what that magic is, but to see that runner coming out with the little buds on the end says, yes, here we are again. Let's start with how to buy an orchid. Any guidelines, Nick?
Well, I would make sure that you look at the leaves and make sure that they're firm and not terribly dark green, kind of medium green is best, shows they're getting enough light. Make sure that you look at the flowers and don't buy plants that have missing buds or ones where you have a whole range of buds and then four of them are brown. Look for the plants that are in good conditions. If they're in a plastic sleeve, as they are in some places, mm-hmm. I'd go ahead and pop them out of the sleeve to see whether or not they've been kind of mangled as they were in that sleeve.
Okay, a couple quick questions. And Dave is pulling out the plastic sleeve and the root is coiled all down at the bottom. Yeah.
And that's perfect. Those are good, healthy, white, happy roots.
I've heard different theories on watering an orchid. Some just hold them up and let the water run through them as mm-hmm. opposed to them sitting in water?
No. The perfect thing is to let them, is to run the water through them. Orchids should be given water when they dry out slightly. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to follow those instructions that you sometimes see on tags that say, oh, just give your orchid 3 ice cubes a week and that's all you need. That's a terrible way to water a plant.
What about the orchid spikes, the food that you can buy to stick in the plant?
They can be fine, but you can probably do it more cheaply and more effectively by just buying any balanced fertilizer, so like a 20-20-20, they'll say on the side, and then use that at quarter strength.
Ah.
Yeah, and do it, you know, 3 times a month. The 4th time, just run the water through it without fertilizer, and that way you'll be flushing out any of the decaying, grounds or making sure that you're getting the salts out of the pot.
That's Sac State Professor Emeritus Nick Burnett. He's the head judge for this weekend's Sacramento Orchid Society show. Does the judging happen this weekend?
It does. It'll happen on Saturday morning between about 10 and 2. We'll be around judging the orchids. People can interact with us and ask questions.
Great.
There'll be members of the society who will be there and able to answer questions as well.
How many varieties do you think you'll be judging?
There'll be hundreds.
Yeah, you just gulped silently.
Yeah, I gulped because it's very hard to keep up with. We don't just judge we say, oh, that's beautiful. We say, how is that in compared to a standard, even if this plant was grown someplace else?
Uh-huh.
So we have research that we consult and facts and figures and statistics and references. And it's a complicated process, but it's great fun.
Dave Veach is the chair of the show and sale. It is the 71st annual, my goodness.
71st annual. And I haven't been involved in all 71. But
you don't look like you could have been.
but this year, we're having one of our biggest shows. As Nick was mentioning, we have a lot of different varieties. I think somewhere on the order of like 450 different varieties of plants.
Wow.
We hope everyone will come and visit us.
And the hours are?
The hours are Saturday from 10 till 5, and then on Sunday from 10 until 4.
At the Scottish Rite Temple in Sacramento. Okay, any final thing to say besides the fact that you're all volunteers or you're part of a nonprofit? You do this out of the love of orchids, right?
That's right.
One
of the things we try to do is to educate the public on how to grow these plants and how to enjoy them. They're not as intimidating as they seem, and we would love for people to just come by because you'll see plants that you may see in a grocery store, but you'll see a lot of plants that you would never see on store shelf that you can actually grow here in Sacramento.
I tweeted at Cap Radio Ruyak a picture of my little greenhouse window over my kitchen sink with my orchids. And I have to say, the more that I've grown them, the more layered I've gotten into how to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a pretty forgiving process at the beginning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, orchids really are actually nowhere near as difficult to grow as most people believe they are. And that's one of the things we do at the show is we offer a class. It's about an hour long, and it will teach people how to take care of orchids.
Great. Well, that's Dave Veach and Nick Burnett from the Sacramento Orchid Society. We'll post a link, okay,
excellent,
to more information. Thanks for the beautiful flowers that you brought in. Aha! Everybody get out there and have fun at the show this weekend. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Settle in to this lovely sound advice with Cap Radio's classical host, Kevin Doherty.
The first piece we're going to talk about recognizes the anniversary of the death of Claude Debussy, the great French impressionistic composer. He died on March 25th in 1918. And this album is a release from celebrated pianist Maurizio Pollini. He's been around for a long time. In fact, 20 years ago, he released an album of book one of Debussy's Preludes. This includes book two. That's sort of the centerpiece of the album. But the real gem is this four hands piano piece, the last three tracks on the album. And it's called En Blanc et Noir, or In Black and White, which I guess he's referring to the keys on the piano.
Makes sense.
Yeah, right. What's really nice about this is he plays it with his 40-year-old son, Daniele.
Really?
Yeah. So the Pollinis are playing together on this one, and I love that. But the heartwarming stuff stops there. With what I'm going to bring to you. Because of the music, you know, the first and third movements are a little bit more uplifting, but the second movement, which is the one I'm going to focus on, is really kind of dark. It's one of his later works, and he wrote it during World War I. After a sort of small period of silence in the composer's output, he's even quoted as saying he had a drought in his brain at that point in his career because of the war. It was sort of imposing on him. So the second movement is dedicated to a friend of his who was a lieutenant in the French army and was killed in action in World War I. And the movement starts off pretty dark. And at one point, Debussy is sort of depicting this battle between the Germans and the French. And he uses the famous Lutheran hymn, which is German in origin, but it's A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. And it was written by Luther himself. So here's just a small clip of the hymn, just so we can hear it in the other piece. I bet that's pretty recognizable.
I think a lot of people know most of the words to that song, too. Yeah.
Maybe not in German, though.
Not in German.
So Debussy uses that in this clip, and it's very much a sort of musical battle between the two pianos, almost like the two armies. And we're sort of pitting this stoic, methodical, German-like music, this German-like hymn that doesn't really change, against this kind of capricious, impressionistic, and virtuosic French style. Let's take a listen.
Talking with Kevin Doherty and this week's Sound Advice. What's next?
So I have a song cycle by Franz Schubert. Schubert was living in a time when symphony and opera reigned supreme, right? And Schubert certainly wrote in all of those styles. But he turned to a more intimate art form, and that was art song, or German Lieder, as they called it. And nobody could set text like Schubert. So this is sort of his magnum opus, Winterreise, or A Winter's Journey. And it sort of follows the life of a man who is forlorn and broken after breaking up with the love of his life. You know, it's better to have loved and lost, but is it really?
Right. So, big question.
Yeah. So not to turn anybody off to this, but it's a pretty sad story throughout the entire thing. But the music is beautiful. And boy, does it reflect imagery like you couldn't believe the text and the music. This is the first time. Maybe not the first time it's been done, but the first time it's been done this well.
Okay.
If that makes sense. We finally get to the last piece of the music. And through this whole song cycle, the protagonist has not met another human being until now. He sees this hurdy-gurdy player. And the hurdy-gurdy is kind of a weird instrument with strings, and it's almost like violin-shaped, and it's got a crank. So,
yeah.
You know, you play it that way, and I'm sure there are some mechanical devices in there that make it work. I couldn't explain.
It's kind of a street-playing instrument.
Yes. But this hurdy-gurdy player is sort of poor. He's very unkempt. And so our protagonist, for the first time, too, also kind of shows empathy toward this person. And he says, no one listens to him. No one notices him. And the dogs growl at the old man. And he just lets it happen as it will, plays. And this hurdy-gurdy is never still. I want you to hear the sort of call and answer between the hurdy-gurdy.
Okay.
And also, just give me your impression of how you think it ends. This is the very end of the song cycle.
Dreht uns eine Leier, steht ihm nimmer still.
So much sadness, but hope. Mm-hmm. Is that too optimistic?
I don't know. And you can sort of, you know, when you listen to the song cycle, you can kind of get your idea of what this means at the end. But I agree with you. I hear
okay.
hope, too. You know, it's so open-ended mm-hmm. at the end, especially in the voice. And there's just that very, very subtle tonic cadence at the end, you know.
Yeah.
But until then, it's just open and it's cold and it's... I think you're right. I think there's hope. I think he's finally sort of moving on to whatever
that
is.
And maybe that's it. Or at least I will keep trying to move forward.
Yeah.
I will
yeah.
keep moving forward.
Yeah. yeah. And the hurdy-gurdy player just keeps going.
Thanks for the prompt to listen closely, because that's when we really learn about the layers of music. But sometimes we need a guide. Kevin.
Yeah, for sure. That's why I'm here.
There you are. So what's next?
All right. Well, this is a newer composition by a woman named Valerie Coleman. She's from Louisville, Kentucky. She's a flutist and the founder of a Grammy-nominated chamber group called the Imani Winds. She began her musical studies at 11 years old and wrote 3 symphonies by the time she was 14. That's
wow.
like Mozart caliber, you know? So this is called Portraits of Langston, and it's based on the poetry of Langston Hughes. And the music is essentially 6 vignettes of Hughes's poetry juxtaposed with readings of this poetry by Oscar winner Mahershala Ali from Moonlight. And I've sort of cut and pasted the part of the text with some of the corresponding music. I mean, in the actual piece, the poetry precedes the music.
Okay.
There's a whole lot to it. It's not just this clip, but the whole piece. It can be frenetic, it's lyric, it's jazzy, and it's just downright beautiful at times. But the clip I've chosen is from Jazz Band at a Parisian Cafe, and I'll let Mahershala and the McGill-McHale Trio kind of do the work for us.
Play it, Jazz Band. You know that tune, that laughs and cries at the same time. You know it. May I? May we? Mein Gott. Parece una rumba. Play it, Jazz Band.
Great trio.
Isn't that cool? Oh, they're a great group. They started in about 2014, the McGill-McHale Trio. Mm. 2 brothers, Anthony and Damare McGill, and Michael McHale is the pianist. And this is one of my favorite albums right now. It really is. There's a lot on it, but that piece, Portraits of Langston, is a lot of fun and worth a listen for anybody.
You have spent some time listening. These are not short recordings. You're investing in this music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right, we have time for one more.
Okay, great. That was the McGill-McHale Trio's debut album. I also have another debut album for us right here. This
okay.
is Inspiration, and the featured artist is cellist Sheku Kana Mason. He's 18 years old, and he won the 2016 BBC Young Artists Competition. That's, you know, BBC. It's a pretty big deal. He comes from a family of of 7 children, all of whom are musicians. Mm. He says that he chose to play the cello because he wanted to be cooler than his big brother who played the violin, so he chose a bigger instrument. I think that's how we all get to be cool.
That's a great story.
But he's a really great cellist. He's got a nice handle on the instrument. The centerpiece is, I mean, it's a big deal for an 18-year-old to play. It's a Shostakovich cello concerto. But the piece I've chosen to listen to, I have this on repeat on my own iTunes right now. It's a piece called The Evening of Roses by Israeli composer Yosef Hadar. It's just beautiful. But Kana Mason learned it while playing in a klezmer band in high school. So it's just interesting. So this is an interesting transcription and arrangement for 8 cellos, clarinet, and cello solo. So let's take a listen to it.
The album again is Inspiration by Sheku Kana Mason. And thanks to Cap Radio's classical host Kevin Doherty for this week's sound advice. Let's close with the Debussy Preludes Book 2 and back to Maurizio Pollini and his son Daniel, 4 hands in their piano duo. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're back again tomorrow.